state of emergency, from caring for kids with extended breaks to the search for tests, how Texans are taking action to deal with coronavirus concerns today on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. We're checking in with reporters statewide to hear how Texans are coping with efforts to keep our distance from each other per the CDC. Also, how the state is tweaking certain rules to accommodate closures. Plus, a market drying up for oil worldwide sends grim signals across one of the state's core industries. Is there a light at the end of the tunnel? Those stories and a whole lot more on the National News Show of Texas. And we'll get started right after this. No matter where you are, you're on Texas Standard Time on this 16th day of March 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. And we hope you and yours have been weathering this extraordinary situation okay so far. Anecdotally, there appears to be a lot of frustration over the lack of coronavirus test kits. I was reading Texas Monthly's State of Texas newsletter this morning with a quote of the day from a mother in Austin who has an ailing 4-year-old son. She told Texas Monthly, "The doctor said, call the CDC. Parents called the CDC. CDC said, call the state. The state said, call Austin Health. Austin Health said, call the pediatrician." And so they got sent in a total circle with zero answers and no one who was actually going to conduct that test. Now, there are signs that things may be changing with drive-up testing at least one location in Austin and another in the Dallas area, although it's not a simple matter as just driving up and asking for a test. Stand by for more on this momentarily. Other parents are dealing with different sorts of questions. For instance, when's school going to be back in session? Texas Tribune reports that the head of the Texas Education Agency is leaving it up to locals to make a determination of how long to remain closed, but he is warning that parents should brace themselves for closures through the end of the academic year. The governor has issued a disaster declaration for all 254 counties in the Lone Star State. And at last check, the CDC had confirmed 24 cases of COVID-19 in Texas, though more people are known to have tested positive for the coronavirus at local labs and are waiting for confirmation from the CDC, which, by the way, is urging no large gatherings for at least 8 weeks. However, the Houston Chronicle reports that the scene in Galveston yesterday, especially around downtown and the seawall beaches, teeming with tourists. Though crowds and lines are way down at airports, except at incoming customs, apparently, where one photo of the scene at DFW went viral, you might say, showing crowds of people waiting to get checked for entry into the U.S., the very sorts of crowds the CDC has been warning everyone to avoid. Let's try to get a larger sense of how Texas is coping by bringing in some reporters from across the state. Nick Garcia joins us. He covers Dallas County government and politics for the Dallas Morning News. Nick, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Let's also bring in Angela Kucherga. She's news director of Public Radio's KTEP in El Paso. Angela, welcome.
Thank you.
Joey Palacios reports for our partners in San Antonio at Texas Public Radio. Joey, good to have you back on the big broadcast.
Thanks, David.
And thanks to you all for being here on a very busy news day. Nick, I want to begin with you because I was mentioning that photograph from DFW, I believe it was. What are officials saying about that? I gather that Governor Abbott saw that and was rather frustrated with the way that the feds are handling customs.
Yeah, so what I understand right now is the scene at DFW is a lot more calm. The bottleneck came from new forms, additional screenings, forms that weren't normally on the plane that, you know, you fill out when you come back in. There was additional screening, so it just caused a huge bottleneck. But from what I saw on TV this morning, the scenes at DFW are a lot better. And I can tell you, Lovefield is basically a ghost town right now. That's the other airport in the Dallas area that's more domestic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Angela, I want to loop you in here because I'm curious what scenes you have there in El Paso. Are people generally staying within their homes or are they out and about?
We have a lot of people out and about. And David, we had our first announcement of a case Friday evening and then another one last night. So over the weekend, things changed for El Pasoans. People still are going out, but We have the added issue of all students are on spring break at the school level, elementary, middle, and high school. Also, University of Texas, El Paso, extended spring break, and probably will continue to have classes online for the remainder of the semester. So in the mindset of people, you know, West Texas seemed to have been the one area that hadn't had a case. Now we're in the same boat as everyone else in the state.
Joey Palacios in San Antonio, obviously that, you know, Riverwalk is a huge tourist attraction. Is that place died down, or what are you seeing?
No, it has not. Actually, one of our interns, Dominic Anthony, was out at the Riverwalk this week, and he saw the, you know, very well-known Rio Cruises still going down, packed full of people. So tourism has not died down in San Antonio yet.
What about the attitude of people there in San Antonio? I think in a lot of Texas cities, there's a sense of lockdown, far fewer cars on the roads, and a lot of empty store shelves. In fact, I believe San Antonio-based HEB announced that it's cutting back its hours so that they can restock shelves. It's sort of an 8-to-8 sort of deal in the Lone Star State. How are people feeling there in San Antonio, Joey?
Well, I mean, you mentioned HEB. One of our reporters, Paul Flav, is actually, he went out to some of the lines at HEB's here in San Antonio and started talking to people to see how they're feeling. And you, when you look at the lines, you know, the stores don't open until 8 o'clock. And already at 7:30, people are already lining up, carts in hand, trying to get into the store. HEB has put in these 8-to-8-hour restrictions, so only being open from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., so that way they can restock overnight.
Well, I want to go back to you, Angela, because you mentioned that there were two cases reported in El Paso. Is that COVID-19 cases or just confirmed coronavirus? Do you know?
Well, these are presumed cases, like everyone, presumptive cases that have to be tested, but they feel pretty confident that's what this is. One is a man who traveled recently to California, and another, we're not clear about his travel history. The other thing I wanted to mention, David, it's interesting. We're in an area where, of course, we're right on the border. It's the largest binational community in the Western Hemisphere, but we're also right on the edge of Texas, and New Mexico has many more cases than we do, and people come back and forth across that state line on a regular basis.
Well, people also use that international entrance and exit to come and go every single day. I've been reading reports that Mexico might try to shut off its border with the United States. Have you heard such stories?
Well, of course, we have heard that. Mexico's president has a morning press conference every day, and Mexico has taken the drastic action of shutting down all public schools across the country starting today and through the Easter holiday. So a lot of students will be out there, and they know a lot of students go back and forth to visit relatives. So clearly on the border, that's a concern. One thing just to mention about the toilet paper, one big grocery store in Mexico actually was, through social media, was showing big, you know, shelves full of toilet paper and trying to lure Texans across to stock up because we have none on our side.
Nick, I want to get back to the issue of testing, which seems to be a major concern for certainly a lot of parents, but a lot of grown-up Texans as well. I understand that Parkland has put in place a kind of drive-through test, but I wouldn't think it's a simple matter of just getting your car in line.
It's not. So that's right. So later today, Parkland will be, which is the county hospital, will begin a mobile testing site that we're starting to see spring up across the country and across Texas. That said, only Parkland patients, first responders, and other healthcare workers who have a note from a Parkland physician can get a test at this site. Now, County Judge Clay Jenkins says he hopes this is the first of many, but for right now, because there are still a lot of restrictions on who can get a test, which is very key here, the state has a very tight restriction on who can get a test. They're limiting to people who have been pre-screened and have an appointment. So people do not or should not go flood Parkland. There is a phone number in our article, dallasnews.com, which is free for everyone to read. If you want to try to figure out if you can get tested, it's suggested you call that phone number. Again, dallasnews.com, and the article about Parkland testing has more details there.
In fact, I understand that other hospitals hospitals are doing something similar, but you have to pass a kind of online screening first. So different areas, different hospitals trying to deal with this situation in different ways. I want to go back to San Antonio and check in with Joy Palacios. Joy, in terms of how the mayor there, Ron Nirenberg, has been reacting to this, there have been calls in some places for tighter restrictions on personal travel. What are you hearing from officials in San Antonio?
Well, I tried asking yesterday, but the city is not saying too much at the moment. They're doing some preparations to see what the next steps are going to be. And as you know, the mayor issued a public health emergency on Friday. That public health emergency is good for 7 days. The next scheduled meeting of the San Antonio City Council is on Thursday, and they do have a review to see if that public health emergency should be extended for another 30 days. Now, it is possible the city could call an emergency meeting, as they did last week, should they need to be an update or any decisions need to be made. But the next time that we're expecting to see the city council see what to do next is on Thursday.
Of course, this is a fast-developing story, and Joy Palacios of Texas Public Radio, as well as Angela Kuchurga of KTEP in El Paso, and Nick Garcia of the Dallas Morning News are among those continuing to bring us the very latest. And folks, we certainly do appreciate you spending a bit of your day with us here on the Texas Standard. Y'all stay safe.
Thank you, David.
Thanks.
Joining us in the studio, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. What are you seeing out there, Wells?
Hi, David. Well, the economic impacts of the coronavirus pandemic coming into increasingly sharp focus as our friends and listeners share their stories with us. Here's one story from a listener on our Facebook page. Denise Garza writes, I am an association meeting planner. One of our highly profitable events just got canceled. Hotels do not consider pandemic's force majeure and will make us honor our contracts. It's been over a $100,000 hit to the budget. She says that if another event in June is also canceled, there will be likely layoffs. Meanwhile, Emily Haygood writes that I have 3 children ages 8 and under, and school is closed for 3 weeks. I'm self-employed in the beauty industry, which means I don't get paid if I don't work. We're taking things one day at a time. And Adam Rosales says he's worried about his favorite local businesses closing in Austin, leaving lots of people without work. So obviously, the ripple effects, David, of this pandemic we're in, impossible to overstate, quite honestly. And we're continuing to see lots more stories like this unfolding on our Facebook page and on Twitter.
Yeah. In fact, there are some changes to state law, some tweaks to state law to help some people weather this situation a little better than they might otherwise. We're going to have more details on that right after the break. We are coming up on 19 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. Don't touch that dial.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises. Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family-owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com. Available in the dairy aisle.
It's Texas Standard Time. Houston, we may have a problem. The $400 billion space industry not immune to coronavirus. CNBC reporting a second NASA employee has tested positive. One works at the Ames Center in Silicon Valley, the other at the Marshall Center in Alabama. NASA maintains that its operations remain on track, though companies including Boeing, Lockheed Martin, and Blue Origin, which has major operations in West Texas, have begun to limit business travel and reschedule events. One concern here is that with many engineers working from home, production and development of new spacecraft could be delayed. Of course, we'll keep you posted.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Because of coronavirus concerns, Governor Abbott now says the state of Texas assessments of academic readiness, or STAR, testing requirements will be waived this school year. Also, if you're concerned about your driver's license expiring, don't worry about it right now. You've got bigger issues to deal with, the governor says. We're going to have more on such accommodations coming up in the Texas Roundup in a couple of minutes. It is hard to imagine at this hour, but things will be back. In what condition, we're not exactly sure, of course, but the fact that so many people are willing to take on losses for the sake of our communities, well, that's something we should all take note of, writes Dr. James Hamblin. He teaches at Yale. He's also staff writer at The Atlantic, and he's been focusing on the coronavirus and our response to it. Jim, thanks for taking time to talk with us.
Thank you for having me.
Things are changing so quickly, and I know many people are commenting on how unprecedented all this is and thinking of best practices. If you're sick, stay home, wash your hands, all of that. You seem to be suggesting it might not be just as simple as that?
No, it's not, unfortunately. You know, most spread is within families, within households. So we need to be making sure that people have a place to go. If you have a large house, you might be able to stay within one room and have somebody bring you food and use a separate bathroom. But the most successful countries have provided isolation facilities where people can go and ride out the disease and get some minor medical care, have some food and medicine, and we don't have that yet.
Some people have said, look, you know, this is like the flu, and yet we know it's not like the flu in other ways. Could you explain why it isn't and in what ways it's actually different?
The reason it is so dangerous is because it can cause mild disease. So it's both transmissible and fatal. When you have a disease that kills 50% of people, it doesn't get transmitted. People get extremely sick and die. And here you have a breakdown that is extremely dangerous. That is the sort of worst case scenario that outbreak experts have modeled. And we know how to treat the flu. We're used to it. We've all had it. We have vaccines. A lot of people are temporarily immune to it right now. So the flu outbreak can't be as bad as this. There's just a lot of uncertainty.
But is there a danger inherent in sort of comparing it to the flu in that perhaps people won't take it as seriously as they should?
Yeah, I think that is a way of downplaying it. The flu kills a lot of people and sickens a lot of people, but we also take it for granted that that is going to happen. I think a lot of people don't even get the flu vaccine. And this is something new. Just because the symptoms are in some ways similar, it's not useful to compare it to something too familiar.
Something that I think a lot of people have yet to sort of wrap their heads around are the long-term implications. Economically speaking, that may seem small when you're talking about life or death decisions, you know, at the coronavirus level. But, you know, you write, to shut down a city or a country is to gamble that incurring disastrous economic consequences in the short term will prevent even more disastrous consequences in the longer term. More disastrous consequences, presumably meaning the future health of citizens, right?
Well, everything. These sci-fi books are the only thing that models the potential for what could possibly go wrong, and everyone is trying to prevent that worst case scenario. You know, if too many people get sick at the same time and the hospitals are overloaded and there's panic and chaos and people can't make rent and everything goes out of business because everyone's afraid to leave their house and spend any money and everyone's just hoarding and stockpiling, that's what everyone needs to avoid. And that's obviously even more economically disastrous than trying to, you know, put in place some temporary closures now in order to mitigate the damage. I liken it to it sort of like a hurricane. It's coming, it's here, hitting the world slightly more slowly, and we have the ability to have it so it hits over a longer period of time. And we're going to get a lot of rain either way, but you don't want that rain coming all in 1 hour. If you could distribute it over the course of a day, you have just a lot less damage.
Is it your sense that things are going to get worse before it gets better? What is your sense of where we are along that continuum?
In the United States?
Yes.
Yes, things are going to get worse before they get better. If we look at the curves of every other country, we've already taken some mitigation steps, recommendations about closing down workplaces and avoiding travel and not having large gatherings. So it won't be as bad as if we had done none of that. But we know, based on every other country and all the data that we have about modeling, that this is going to spread widely. And the best estimates are still anywhere from 30 to 70% of Americans becoming infected over the next year to year and a half if we don't take even more aggressive measures to mitigate the spread. And with a fatality rate of about 1%, We're still not exactly sure what that is. You know, that's a lot of damage.
Let me follow on with that, because you were mentioning a rather long timeline there. And I think right now in the heads of a lot of folks, it's like, okay, well, give us 2 weeks. Maybe we can then start to think about, you know, rebooking those flights. No.
No. Well, travel is going to be a big question. What we need right now is we're buying some time. There are emergency supplies of masks going into production. There are hospitals are bracing for this surge. We're just starting to get our testing capacities up so we can get a better idea of exactly who will need what level of care, mm-hmm. when people can be discharged, where they can go. It's best to play it extremely cautious right now, buy as much time as we can, and hopefully things will be okay enough that we can not totally have to shut down in the near future, and might even be able to feel better about things in coming months.
It sounds like you're playing it rather cautious in terms of how you talk about that timeline too.
Right. The disaster scenario I mentioned is really just what we're trying to make sure we prevent right now. It will become clear pretty quickly how well that's working for us. And if you look at Italy, they didn't shut down too much, and they were quickly overloaded. The hospitals were quickly overloaded. Mm-hmm. They had to move to really dramatic measures real quickly. In this country, I don't have reason to believe that we are better prepared than they are. We're taking some measures, which feel extreme to us, because we didn't really have an idea of how widespread the disease was, because we weren't testing for it. But we're so far behind the ball right now that I'm not optimistic that we'll fare better than they have.
Dr. James Hamlin is a preventative medicine physician. He teaches at Yale. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic. Dr. Hamlin, thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas A&M University, striving to maintain a tradition of cultivating courageous leaders focused on global impact and innovation. Texas A&M University, fearless on every front. More at fearlessfront.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, with a reminder that March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. Screening can lead to early detection and is recommended for all men and women age 50 and older. More at texasoncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Texas grade school and high school students are off the hook from taking the state's standardized tests that were scheduled for April. Governor Greg Abbott this morning waived the STAR exam requirements in response to class disruptions from the coronavirus outbreak. Texas State Teachers Association President Noel Condalaria says canceling the test will allow schools to prioritize the health of their students and staff.
The last thing we need right now is for students and parents to be focused on the impact of STAR tests and kids' graduations, and what does that mean for them moving on to the next grade level.
Governor Greg Abbott is also requesting the U.S. Department of Education waive federal standardized testing requirements for the current school year. The Texas Department of Agriculture is now accepting applications to grow hemp, the non-psychoactive cousin of marijuana. The agency hammered out rules and regulations for the crop after the state legislature passed a bill last year to legalize its cultivation. The Texas Standard's Michael Marks has more.
Whether you plan to grow 1 acre of hemp or 1,000, you have to have a license issued by the Texas Department of Agriculture. The application is open to anyone and must be submitted online. It does require a criminal background check, and applicants convicted of a drug-related felony in the past 10 years will be disqualified. The state charges $100 each for a license, facility fee, and lot permit, so producers must pay TDA $300 before even planting a seed. I'm Michael Marks in Austin.
A proposed rule aimed at increasing transparency in how hospitals spend Medicaid funds could end up costing Texas hospitals billions of dollars. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports federal officials are currently deciding whether to adopt the change.
The rule would change how Texas hospitals get paid for the care they provide to uninsured patients. Texas has the highest uninsured rate in the country, so that money is substantial. Jennifer Banda with the Texas Hospital Association says this rule could amount to an $11 billion loss for hospitals in the state.
And what that will ultimately do is it's either going to require hospitals to cut back on services or to make up for those loss of dollars, we're going to have to see local communities raise their taxes. And, you know, I think the outcome of that, we're going to see some widespread impact across the state.
Both Republican and Democratic members of the Texas congressional delegation recently sent a letter to federal health officials asking them not to implement this proposed rule.
Ashley Lopez reporting. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Abilene Christian University, focusing on student success within key areas like service learning, first-year experiences, and learning communities. More at acu.edu.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Before women got the vote in 1920, heck, before white Texas women got to vote in primaries in 1918, Texas men had already elected a woman as mayor. Her name was Ophelia Harwood, but lots of locals knew her as Birdie. Her story is so fascinating, we invited Suzanne Freeman to tell us about her. She knows all about this woman, the first woman elected as mayor in Texas. She's editor-in-chief of the Picayune magazine, which is based in Marble Falls, Texas, as I understand it. Suzanne Freeman, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Marble Falls, Texas is the place where Birdie Harwood was elected mayor, right?
Right, and where my mother was born and raised. And she actually knew Birdie. Her first memory of being whooped, as they say, in Texas, her first memory of a good spanking was out in Birdie Harwood's front yard.
What did your mom do?
She was toddling around the edge of a pond in Birdie's front yard and balancing on the rocks, and she had been told a million times not to do that.
Mm-mm.
And of course she did it. They said, you're going to fall in, and she fell in. And she got a spanking.
Got in trouble for it. Well, that must have been quite a vivid memory indeed. But tell us a little bit more about Birdie. Why was she elected? And I understand she considered herself to be in a peculiar position, for example.
Well, she put together an ad for the Marble Falls Messenger as her plea for why they should vote for her. And her basic thing was that a woman is especially qualified to run and to serve in a local community because of her experience running household, and that rich men didn't want the job, poor men couldn't afford the job, but that women were especially fit for the job.
How interesting. What was she well known in Marble Falls?
Yeah, her husband was a doctor. She was very active, her and her husband both, in the community. So she was well known. And she ran on a platform of open government. And she published the city's budgets in the local newspaper, the Marble Falls Messenger, twice a year, just as she promised. And she promised to be conservative with their money. And she was the one who put in the first streetlights in downtown, or lit the downtown area. I'm not exactly sure how, but she also helped put in streets.
Yeah, get them done.
And then set up the first laws for how to act on those streets if you had a car, honking your horn when you turned a corner, and the kind of things that we don't have to do now, but then they had no other stop signs or anything else. So she set up some rules and regulations.
And we're talking about, just to make sure that we're all on the same page in terms of the time period, this is around the time of World War I or so?
Yep. In fact, it was 1917. All three of her sons fought in the war. And when the war started, she set up an American Red Cross station there in Marble Falls and had, you know, they were making bandages and doing all the stuff that they do.
You know, this stands in stark contrast to some mayors who are sort of caretakers for the city. It sounds like she sort of took a rather progressive stand, certainly in Texas at the time.
She did. She was very progressive, but very conservative when it came to money. She was a Democrat. She professed herself to be a Democrat, but she was that Democrat, you know, that we had back in the day that was a moderate, a centrist.
Is there truth to some, there's a story about LBJ and how he needed a microscope?
Well, what happened was, and this comes to light in a letter that the late Senator Walter Richter, corresponding with Lady Bird Johnson, and they were trying to establish proof that the two knew each other, because Birdie was originally from Johnson City. She was very interested in education, and he was had a job to raise money to go to school delivering milk in the city. Mm-hmm. And he delivered milk to her house one day, and she knew he was interested in science, so she gave him a microscope. This came out, too, in a letter that her granddaughter wrote, And she said she remembers being in the living room when it happened. She was a child, and she was standing there in her shorts, embarrassed. And now thinking back, well, that was a that guy became president. She got even more embarrassed in retrospect.
That's so interesting. And she, you know, after she was mayor, she didn't just disappear. She went on to be Texas's first woman municipal court judge.
Yep, she did, and she did quite a lot of things in the community. Still, the Red Cross she ran, and one of the things that I find kind of interesting, all this information comes out of the Falls on the Colorado Museum, which is in the old Granite School building in Marble Falls. And there's a story her granddaughter tells about piling all the grandkids in the car every morning to take them to school, and they go to that building. And she was said they were 5 minutes late every single time. But you can still, when you drive up and park and go into the Falls on the Colorado Museum, that's right where she was dropping off those grandkids and sending them to school. It's also where my mother went to school.
Suzanne Freeman is keeping history alive with a fascinating story she's written about a remarkable Texas woman. Her name was Birdie, or Ophelia, Harwood. And we're going to have a link to your story over at texasstandard.org. And it's definitely worth checking out. Very nice to meet you. Thank you so much for stopping by the studio.
Well, thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, honoring North American birds lost to extinction with the opening of the Lost Bird Project exhibition and the unveiling of the Eskimo Curlew Memorial Sculpture on March 29th. Galveston.com/lostbird. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Amid all the coronavirus news, a story we continue to track, of course, something you may have missed last week. Iconic Dallas luxury retailer Neiman Marcus announced it would be closing most of its Last Call stores. For the non-shopaholics listening, this is Neiman's discount chain offering markdowns on styles like big-name fashion houses and the like. The brand will be shuttering most of its 22 Last Call stores, as well as two of its distribution centers, both in Texas, one in Irving and one in Longview. Here with more is Kathleen Chen. She reports on the industry for businessoffashion.com. Kat, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
You know, I want to say discount retailer. It's not exactly a discount retailer. It's just lower prices on luxury goods, right?
Yes, exactly. They'll use these stores to get rid of a lot of excess inventory from leftover seasons.
So was this expected? I mean, did people see this coming?
Yeah, the CEO told me that they've been working on scaling back Last Call for the past 18 months because they want to focus on the full price customer. That customer will spend, upwards of $50,000 a year with Neiman versus the discount customer, who may not have the spending power to buy any much more than they were already planning to buy, even if Neiman spends the marketing dollars to get them to buy more.
Well, I wonder then if this should be filed as another story about the death of brick and mortar retail stores, or if we're talking about a particularly rarefied niche of retail somehow.
Well, surely all of retail is incredibly challenged right now. Saks Fifth Avenue. Nordstrom is doing okay, but everyone is facing the same slate of challenges. Now for Neiman Marcus, as far as we know, the past 2 years hasn't been bad in terms of sales performance. They're pulling in, more than $1 billion every quarter. But the problem is, and this is the case with many struggling retailers, is that they're not making any profit on these sales. So for Neiman Marcus, they may be making, upwards of $4 billion every year, but they're losing $30 million each quarter just to operate and market the business.
Wow. You talk about the marketing. I think something that a lot of people don't realize, if you go to the story of Texas, which is like a major history museum here in the Lone Star State, there's a special section where they talk about the rise of Neiman Marcus and how it represented the oil boom going back to the turn of the century, Spindletop. There's a whole legend built up around this. And Neiman Marcus was a way to sort of cater to the families of the suddenly rich. Now, I wonder what Neiman Marcus means in the minds of the average consumer today, since it's obviously much bigger than just a Texas thing.
Right. I think that clientele, that classic clientele of the Texan ladies, I think that's still very much part of what Neiman Marcus stands for. They actually opened their first store in New York in Hudson Yards last year. And, you know, since Neiman Marcus stopped reporting financial results as of last summer, mm-hmm. we're not really sure how well they're doing on that front. Neiman also owns Bergdorf Goodman, which mm-hmm. is probably New York's, you know, most iconic department store. A lot of people don't know that. And it makes sense, you know, that they would have this exposure on the East Coast as well. Now, in terms of younger consumers, I don't know. I don't have any friends who shop at Neiman Marcus or Bergdorf's. So I'm not sure if that sort of glamorous department store, you know, that's 100,000 mm-hmm, square feet, mm-hmm. you know, with the perfume ladies spritzing perfume. I do think that some of that is becoming obsolete.
Kat Chen is a reporter for businessoffashion.com, and they continue to monitor changes for Neiman Marcus. Kat, thanks so much for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Of course, it was my pleasure.
Can a mother's sadness affect her children's well-being? Well, a new study finds kids who blame themselves for their mother's depressive symptoms have a higher risk of developing depression themselves. One North Texas mom's trying to break that cycle and build understanding with her own kids. KERA's Saida Hassan has that story.
Growing up, Denton resident Amanda Dolan didn't understand why her mother spent days crying and struggling to get out of bed. Dolan wondered if she'd done something wrong, and she tried and failed to cheer her mother up.
I knew that she was sick, but I didn't have a name for it.
Dolan's mother was diagnosed with depression, and eventually she found effective treatment. When Dolan was a teenager, she began seeing a psychiatrist. That's when it clicked that she wasn't to blame for her mother's sadness.
I realized it wasn't about me, it was about her, and that she was truly doing the best that she could.
As an adult, Dolan sought treatment for her own mental illness. She was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and she's experienced postpartum depression. For years, she struggled to find her way.
By the time my kids were 4 and 5, I was really stuck in a really bad place. I remember my daughter regularly asking me, "Mommy, why is the house dirty? Mommy, why don't I have clothes to wear?"
Dolan now manages her illness with medication, and she's open with her kids about it. The family members keep an open dialogue about how they're feeling. So when Dolan's daughter was about 10 and began experiencing symptoms of depression, she came to her mom.
And we were able to talk to her doctor and get her therapy and get her on a very low dose of medication. And she is just thriving now.
Researchers at Dallas's Southern Methodist University are trying to understand how mothers' depressive symptoms can shape their children's mental health. A new SMU study finds kids who assume responsibility for their mom's sadness are more likely to face depression and anxiety themselves. Family psychologist Christina Kouros is the lead author.
There was a group of children who made what we call these negative attributions in which they blamed themselves. They thought that their mom's depression had something to do with them, or they caused it, or they were responsible for it.
Researchers surveyed 129 North Texas moms and their children. Kuro says most of the mothers were not diagnosed with depression. But she says even expressing normal, everyday feelings of sadness can affect children's development. Kuro says kids who tend to blame themselves are more likely to internalize their mother's symptoms of depression and anxiety. Some of those children may fixate on negative thoughts. Others may try unsuccessfully to cheer their mothers up, which can leave them feeling helpless. Kuro says some moms try to protect their children by hiding sad feelings, but that can backfire. Kids can often pick up on sadness, but they're not always great at deciphering the why.
In most cases, it's not their fault or it's not the cause of their mom's depression. So even though children are perceptive and they're picking up, they might not always have the right interpretation.
Kouros encourages parents to pay attention to children's comments and correct any misconceptions. Let them know it's not their fault if their mom feels sad, and it's not their job to make it better. That's a practice Amanda Dolan uses in her home.
say to your child, I'm feeling really sad today, and to really tell the child that it is not their fault and that you love them and this will pass, but I'm going to need some time.
Dolan says if you let kids know that it's normal to feel sad sometimes, there's less room for misunderstanding. I'm Saida Hassan in Dallas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. How low can it go? A new low for oil prices this morning. West Texas Intermediate crude dipped below the $30 mark, the lowest level since 2016, we're told. No question that the oil industry has been feeling the effects of coronavirus, but there's a whole lot more at work. Sort of perfect storm happening for the Permian, you might say. Here with an update, Energy Insider Matt Smith. He's director of commodity research at Clipper Data, and he joins us every couple of weeks here on The Standard. Matt, welcome back.
Thanks, David.
This seems like rather grim news indeed, this West Texas Intermediate being below $30 a barrel today. This isn't just about coronavirus.
Right, that's right. And you mentioned it there, perfect storm. We've really seen this drop in oil prices initiated from the OPEC meeting where they were unable to make a decision in terms of a additional production cut. But that has now combined with the coronavirus to send prices spiraling lower, as you mentioned there, back to the lowest since 2016. But if you look at WTI, it's down 55% from early January. So we're just in a free fall here.
Well, how much of this is about that price war, and how much of it is because the world's just not demanding that much oil because everyone's in lockdown mode?
It's both. That's the biggest challenge about it, is that it's a demand side thing and a supply side thing. So from the supply side of things, that's not fully hit the market yet, because Saudi has said they're going to open the spigots. That takes time, and that crude has been bought for next month, and so that's going to be hitting the water pretty soon. In retaliation to that as well, you're seeing Russia pushing more onto the market and UAE as well. So from a supply side of things, it's only going to get worse in the coming month or so. At the same time as well, with the demand side of the picture, we've seen China hugely dented in terms of their demand because of their economy basically shutting up shop for a temporary period. Now that they're starting to get back to work, the impact is now sweeping across to Europe and the U.S.
Yeah. I want to just imagine a scenario where if I'm in the oil drilling business, I'm thinking to myself, well, these prices are getting so low, I'm not sure if it's going to be worth it for me to continue to try to extract oil from the ground. Is that already happening now in the Permian Basin? Are people just sort of saying, nope, this just doesn't make any economic sense for us to do extraction?
Right. We're already there. We're already past that point. Yeah, for a number of these producers across the various shale plays in the U.S., this is, you know, disastrous for the Texas economy, really. Companies are slashing spending. People are losing jobs. Drilling activity is being halted. And the challenge is as well is that it's difficult to see a turnaround to this situation anytime soon. We know that the oil industry has this history of boom and bust.
Right.
And yet here we go again.
Do you think that do you see any light at the end of the tunnel? If someone were to say, when's this pain going to end? What would you tell them?
I'd be honest. And the funny thing is, as well, us just talking here, I can hear in your voice, you know, we're typically upbeat. And I find it kind of difficult to be upbeat right now. And it seems like you're the same too, you know. Mm. It's because it feels that it's going to get worse before it gets better. And that's simply because, just from a macro perspective, after we saw China grind to a halt, you've now got European countries that are stopping flights, closing borders. While here in the US, you've got New York shutting down its restaurants on one side of the country, and then you've got the Las Vegas Strip being closed down on the other. Mm-hmm. So from an all market perspective, the demand picture continues to worsen. So yeah, there's not a great deal of good news out there at the moment.
Matt Smith continues to track things as they develop. He's director of commodity research at Clipper Data. Matt, some tough information to swallow, but we appreciate you continuing to follow this for us. Thanks again.
Thanks, David.
And you were listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar, our social media editor, continues to track what Texans are talking about. And, of course, a lot of concerns about the economy there and not knowing what to do with the kids in particular.
Yeah, I can speak to that one from experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah, odd weekend out there. I think it really became real for a lot of people as these coronavirus woes obviously have people social distancing, staying away from others to slow the potential transmission of the virus that causes COVID-19. Of course, not everyone was, you know, just anecdotally, David. I had my big outing, my big trip to HEB on Saturday. Mm-hmm. And along the stretch of road, I pass a couple beer gardens and just all of them packed. Lots of people out there. Many people sort of anticipating a kind of a last hurrah, you know, because we are seeing these closures of restaurants and bars and other cities. And the CDC making these new recommendations to limit events to 50 or fewer people. So we put the question up on our Facebook page asking if our friends and listeners are social distancing, and if not, why. Interesting responses here. Jesse J. Mata says he's absolutely engaging in social distancing. He asks, why would anyone want to risk the same outcome as Italy, where a blasé attitude at the early stages failed to contain the spread? He says, let's learn and let our approach evolve to protect the community as a whole. If we don't get our collective head out of the sand, this thing is going to thoroughly hurt us. And of course, David, as we were just talking about the economic impacts, people trying to sort of balance those two components, the sort of economic one with all these small businesses or large businesses, mm-hmm, for that matter, mm-hmm, being potentially impacted with the public health concerns. Julie Lucas, she has a really interesting story here as well. She says she's been too busy running our food pantry to stay home. We're using an overabundance of caution to make sure we don't get our clients or ourselves sick. We're limiting contact, having clients drive by, and we drop boxes in their trunks. We may even start delivering to our more vulnerable clients who rely on public transportation. I just wish I had some freaking toilet paper to give out, she writes. Obviously, yeah, another story there on social.
Completely understand the whole toilet paper
thing. I don't quite get it either, but I did see someone, I can't remember where I saw it on Twitter, I can't remember who exactly said it, but they were speaking to a sort of a psychologist, and it's like in these moments where people do those sort of panic buying things, they're looking for something big, they're looking for like a good value, mm-hmm, so you see like a 24-pack of toilet paper for, you know, $12, you're, mm-hmm, like, okay, I'm going to get that. I'm going to feel prepared. It's more of a psychological than much anything else, I would think.
The interesting thing happening with the markets, of course, for a brief period this morning, trading was temporarily halted because of concerns about what the Fed did and whether or not they're going to have a whole lot more leverage as the economy gets worse.
I think there's like the third incident in the last, like, what, 5 days or so where they do that temporary halt on trading as things plummet so quickly.
Some interesting stuff from some of the top traders. They say yes, there is the pandemic, and you do have the market falling. But rather than continuing to check your 401k, which can be, you know, the first thing you do, something that you should probably do is think about your willingness to survive risk. In other words, just start to reevaluate how much you're willing to tolerate that risk. Because eventually, this is not one of those things that, I mean, the worst investing decisions are made out of fear. So whatever you do, don't do it in that state of panic that some people may be feeling at the moment. We're out of time for the big broadcast, but we're going to be back here tomorrow, and we hope you will join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the Texas Standard crew, wishing you a marvelous Monday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.